And to honor our mothers today, we do have some homegrown roses. They're not the store-bought kind. These are homegrown. Audrey has a few flowers. Some of them are, well, if they came from Osh, they'll be good. I know. So Audrey confessed they aren't all homegrown, but that's okay. So Audrey was kind enough to prepare some flowers for our ladies today in honor of Mother's Day. So I think we have some special means of distributing those flowers too after services. So don't leave without getting your flower in honor of Mother's Day. Does anyone know in what year Mother's Day was officially set aside here in the United States? I would safely state here, and the ladies will love me for this, it was set long before any of you here were born. Is that safe? The second Sunday in May was set aside to honor mothers by William Glasscock, the governor of West Virginia, in the year 1910. And when you think about it, motherhood is one of the highest callings that a human being can experience. When you hear the term mother, what images and what conceptions come to mind? I'm sure you can all focus on that word and think back time and space to your early life. My guess is that your vision and your impression that comes to mind as you hear the term mother would not be either of these two extremes, the first being the barefoot and pregnant woman with a washboard in one hand and a whole string of children tagging along on the other hand, and neither mother nor children are to be heard from. They are to be silent and just there. And on the other hand, I'm sure that most of us would not have a vision of the contemporary view of motherhood, in which actually the term is virtually non-existent. The title is deemed gender neutral and can be readily assigned to either a nurturing male or female who happens to be the household's primary caregiver for children. In our contemporary culture, the role of the traditional father as provider and protector has been relegated to essentially ancient history. The term single parent family, with mothers being the single parent in most cases, has become reality. As a society, we are now on the verge of accepting same-sex partners as legitimate parents, and a family can be any combination of adults and children, it seems. So we have come quite a ways in terms of how we approach this subject and understand the concept of motherhood since William Glasscock, governor of West Virginia, established Mother's Day in 1910. I'd like to read a couple of alternate perspectives for you to consider as you consider your concept of mother and motherhood. These quotes are taken from a book entitled Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. It's a selection of writings. In this case, these quotes are taken from an article written by John Piper, and it is also a part of the opening comments of the book, Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. He describes his growing up years and his impressions of his mother and his memories. He writes, "It never occurred to me to think of my mother and my father in the same category. Both were strong, both were bright, both were kind. Both would kiss me, and both would spank me. Both were good with words. Both prayed with fervor and loved the Bible. But unmistakably, Father was a man, and my mother was a woman. They knew it, and I knew it. It never occurred to me that leadership and submission had anything to do with superiority and inferiority. And it didn't have to do with muscles and skills either. It was not a matter of capabilities and competencies. I know that the specific rhythm of life that was in our home is not the only good one, but there were dimensions of reality and goodness in it that ought to be there in every home. Indeed, they ought to be there in varying ways in all mature relationships between men and women. I now say ought to be there because I now see they were rooted in God. Over the years, I have come to see from Scripture and from life that manhood and womanhood are the beautiful handiwork of a good and loving God. He designed our differences, and they are profound. Would anyone argue that? Not me. They are not the mere physiological prerequisites for sexual union. They go to the root of our personhood. In other words, what he's saying is the differences between men and women are not purely physiological. It reaches far beyond that, and we'll talk a little bit about that this afternoon. Here's another quote from Alexis de Tocqueville. He is a French author and statesman who toured and traveled America in the 1830s, went back home and wrote about his experiences. You probably read some of his writings over the years. Here is his impression of the American female. Now, this is in the 1830s. Now, I think this was probably before most of you ladies were born, too, so I'm throwing that out there the second time. Americans have never supposed that one consequence of democratic principles is the subversion of marital power or the confusion of the natural authority in families. They hold that every association must have a head in order to accomplish its object, and that the natural head of the conjugal association is man. So he's writing about America in the 1830s, and really, in a sense, as you read through his quotation, you'll find that he's marveling at the social structure that remains intact in America, at least at that point it was, that holds that the husband or the man is the head of his house. This opinion is not peculiar to one sex and contested by the other. In other words, this isn't cheered by the man and condemned by the woman. I never observed that the women of America considered conjugal authority as a fortunate usurpation of their rights, or that they thought themselves degraded by submitting to it. Americans do not think that man and woman have either the duty or the right to perform the same offices, but they show an equal regard for both their respective parts, and though their lot is different, they consider both of them as being of equal value. If I were asked now that I am drawing to the close of this work, that is his compilation of written experiences regarding his trip and tour of America, in which I have spoken of so many important things done by the Americans, to what the singular prosperity and growing strength of that people ought mainly to be attributed. Now, to put it in plain English, he's a Frenchman writing in English. He said, if someone were to ask me, what is the most powerful attribute that you recognize in your tour of America that made America a great nation? If you could only pick out one attribute and one thing, what would it be? He states, I should have to reply, I would attribute their strength and superiority as a nation to the superiority of their women. That hurt a little bit, but I read it anyway. But you understand what he's saying. It's they understood their roles. They weren't in competition. They understood they were of equal value. They understood the responsibility for leadership in the family, and they were able to make it work for them. And that's something he actually marveled at. This was in the year 1840 that he completed his work and wrapped up his writing concerning his American tour. Now, when one contemplates these perspectives, there's an undeniable focus on the equality of value and respect for men and women and their roles individually, yet also an absolute recognition of the complementary nature and distinctiveness of each role as well. In other words, each role is distinct and different. Husband, wife, father, mother, and yet the complementary nature of each role. The need for both, for instance, mother and father, was undoubtedly designed and created by the great God to provide the perfect cocoon for the raising and rearing of children. And, of course, mothers have a very important role to play in that regard, don't we? And when you think about it, I wonder if God created men and women, male and female, in an effort to show the vast and complex nature of God Himself. Or we find the dramatic and tremendous differences between the genders or the sexes. We find in marriage, we find in families, the outstanding variety of perspectives and outlooks and personalities and all of the things that go into making men men and women women and marriages marriages. And it is a marvelous thing to consider. Was man intended to predominantly reflect God as a leader, a guide, a loving authority, one to respect, the primary disciplinarian, the protector and provider? You think God may have had that in mind when he created man? Now, conversely, were women created and given their natural aptitudes and drives to reflect the helper nature of God and some of his other qualities and characteristics like comforter, nurturer, God is love, the keeper of the hearth and home, the relational side of God? Is that possibly what God had in mind? Of course, our experience would tell us that it would be rather unusual, difficult, if not impossible, to express the broad and all-encompassing nature of God in one gender. Can you imagine one being, or one gender, if you will, one human creation that expressed all of those characteristics and qualities that I mentioned? Would be quite a challenge, wouldn't it? I know being a father, being a husband, being a male, when I read those qualities that I read that are usually attributed to men, I find that some of them I'm more in tune with than others. And aren't we all the same, regardless of our gender? Men and women do share many aptitudes and responsibilities, which can be manifested and carried out and achieved and accomplished interchangeably. In other words, we can both do stuff. And some can do it a little better than others, but we can, both genders can do a lot of the same things. However, is there a predominant purpose and focus for which each gender was created, and which each gender personifies in the home and in society? And is one of those roles, specifically for the female, that of mother? In other words, can a father really fulfill the role of a mother? And vice versa, obviously, but today we'd like to talk about mothers. So this afternoon, let's focus on the unique role and calling of motherhood. And as we do, let's examine our Heavenly Father's attention to every detail in His creation of woman and the establishment of motherhood, a role fulfilled by being ideally suited to the task of bearing and mothering children. Well, first of all, let's take a look at the physiological differences between men and women. I've got some quotations and some information here that I thought you might find interesting. So what is the difference between men and women anyway? We can't possibly cover all of that today. Too many of them, but we'll cover a few. Most of this information that I'll relay to you here initially is taken from a book by Dr. James Dobson, Bringing Up Boys is the title. Once again, the closer man looks at God's creation, the more convinced he should become of God's power and existence. Listen to this description of a little embryo. And some of these things I found quite fascinating. You may have known this already. At 6 to 7 weeks of gestation, all embryos are technically females. Yay, rah, rah for the ladies. So we all start out as girls, which is as it should be. At this point, 6 to 7 weeks into gestation, the embryos that have the Y chromosome experience a sudden spike in its levels of the hormone testosterone. So now the males are starting to separate from the females, and there's a spike in the levels of testosterone at 6 to 7 weeks. Modern scientific research has proven that this event actually affects the walnut-sized brain and alters its structure. So at 6 to 7 weeks, the embryo has a walnut-sized brain, and it's affected by this transformation and the chromosomal spike in testosterone. There are other things that happen in the gestation process that separate male from female, boys from girls. The corpus callosum, which is the rope of nerve fibers that connects the two hemispheres of the brain, is made less efficient, that is, in the male, and you ladies knew that anyway, limiting the number of electrical transmissions that can flow from one side of the brain to the other. This may cause men to think longer about what they believe. So the silence is thinking. We're thinking, trying to get the electrical impulses to cross the two lobes of the brain. And you're wondering if we really have two lobes or just one, but we do have two. It's very difficult in some cases for men to think and to consider things emotional. The emotional component is not as readily recognizable or usable within the male. In fact, emotional issues he might find difficult to comprehend. Facts, figures, mathematics, chemical equations. Look, we're going out to dinner. What's the big deal? Who cares where we go? Just throw some clothes on. I don't care what you wear. Your hair looks fine. Yeah. Forget it. Don't be so sensitive. Caring, loving comments like that. Those are the kinds of emotionally supportive things we tend to say as males. Now, on the other hand, a woman will typically be able to access her prior experiences from both hemispheres and discern almost instantly how she feels about any subject. So you want to strike up a conversation with a woman, ask her how she feels about any subject, and that will take a couple of hours to complete. But for us men, ask us how we feel we'll get the deer in the headlights look and try to get those synapses to connect and the electrical charges to fire, and we'll think, and finally we'll come out with, well, I don't know how I feel about that. I'll tell you tomorrow. But now, of course, even as males and females age or mature, the changes continue. After puberty, testosterone levels in the male are 15 times that of females, and estrogen in females 8 to 10 times more than the level in males. And of course, these are the critical hormonal components that give male and female characteristics, as we know. Testosterone correlates with psychological dominance, confident physicality, and high self-esteem. And there are other qualities and characteristics you could attribute to testosterone. And again, this is basically taken from Dr. Dobson's work. It's interesting to note that of 250 cultures studied by anthropologists, males dominate in almost all of them. And if you think about it, the testosterone has a big part to play in it. Males are almost always the rule makers, the hunters, the builders, the fashioners of weapons, workers in metal, wood, or stone. On the other hand, women are primarily caregivers and most involved in childrearing, with their activities centering upon the maintenance and care of home and family. Now, serotonin is another hormone that affects human behavior. It facilitates the transfer of information from one nerve cell to another. This hormone pacifies or soothes the emotions and helps an individual control their impulsive behavior. It also facilitates good judgment. If testosterone is like the gasoline that powers the brain, serotonin slows the speed and helps one steer. Now, of the two genders, which gender has more serotonin? In most cases. Anybody want to venture a guess? Females? How would you know? You're a male, Bob. Bob is right. He wins a free big strawberry after services. Bob is right. Females typically have more serotonin than males. That's why they aren't so sudden in their decisions. That's why they don't jump to conclusions. That's why they're not as impulsive. The ladies have that serotonin. Now that I describe this, some of you probably would like to inject your husbands with serotonin and get them to be more careful and take less risks, because as you know, the male of the species tends to be undertaking more at-risk behaviors. Now here's another physiological difference. The amygdala is an organ the size of an almond. It's part of the brain, and it's a small but powerful emotional computer. When a physical or emotional threat is perceived, it triggers the release of adrenaline and other defensive organs swing into action. The amygdala is larger in males than in females, and combined with high levels of testosterone in the male, it may account for the all too typical at-risk behavior of men. So you see, all of these physiological differences are there. And we all start out as females, but after 6 or 7 weeks, the transformation begins. Generally speaking, and due to the specialization of their brains, males are typically better than females. Typically, didn't say in every case, typically better than females at math, science, spatial relations, logic, and reasoning. On the other hand, females make fewer mistakes. They take fewer risks. Generally, they are better students. They are more thoughtful of others, and they are less impulsive. Perhaps with the exception of shopping. Maybe impulsively buy some things. Now, consider, because it is the privilege and blessing of women to bear children, they, physiologically, as we tried to describe here, are inclined toward predictability. You know, as a dad, I like to throw my kids up in the air and swing them around and take them on motorcycle rides and go-kart rides. And, you know, mothers are a little more hesitant and they want to protect the children from the impulsive behavior of daddy sometimes. But when you consider the general nature of women, their inclination toward predictability, stability, security, caution, and steadiness, as opposed to the risk-taking, carefree, throw them up in the air and answer the phone, dad, who sometimes loses track of things like that, doesn't it make sense that mothers are the kind of people they are for a reason? Most value friendships and family above accomplishments or opportunities. Her temperament lends itself to nurturance, caring, sensitivity, tenderness, and compassion, the precise characteristics needed by children during their developmental years. Men are simply designed for a different role. They value risk, opportunity, change, adventure, speculation. They are designed to provide for and protect their families. They have an aggressive nature. In bicycle parlance, if a man is the pedal, then the woman is the brake. The man is the pedal, the woman is the brake. Men and women respond differently to stress, and they are stressed by different environmental factors. Women are more comfortable with and gravitate to social interaction and communication. They have physiologies and temperaments that prepare them uniquely for childcare. And the inevitable, mommy, what is this? Mommy, why does that happen this way? Where are we going now? Are we there yet? When will we be there? What are we going to do when we get there? Why aren't we there yet? Where is daddy? Etc. They can do this. They have the ability to provide the basic needs that little children have. They are prepared uniquely for child care. The inability to have children or to provide basic needs for a child are also common sources of feminine stress. So if I can't provide for my little children, I'm stressed out by that. I need to provide for them and give them the emotional support they're looking for. Women find fulfillment in caring for others and meeting needs. Men appear to be more stressed when frustrated in goal achievement or when they feel a lack of control of their surroundings. That's the male. They're not as in tune with the emotional needs of little children or others in general. Men are also stressed when frustrated in sexual fulfillment or when they sense a lack of support or respect from their wife and family. Now, these comments were taken from a book entitled Biological Basis for Gender-Specific Behavior by Greg Johnson. Now, here are a couple of tests that have been run over the years. I want you to note the difference in response to visual stimulus or stimuli between men and women. These are some interesting experiments. The outcomes are predictable, but it just reinforces the point. In experiments to measure the effect of visual stimuli on the brain, men and women were shown identical pictures and their response was measured. For the man, he was shown a flower, a sports car, and a naked woman. I hope that doesn't offend anyone. It's just a test, experiment, a picture. When he saw the flower, flatline. Sports car, fluttering line. The female that I described a moment ago, skyrocketing line. Now, of course, I don't know why they had to run a test to figure that out. But anyway, for the woman, flower, fluttering line. Remember, man, flat line. Sports car, for the woman, flat line. For the man, fluttering line. Now, these are just general observations. And, in this case, the picture of a naked man was shown to the woman. There was a slight flutter, and then she went flat. Honestly, I didn't write this. This was taken from scientific experimentation. And when the woman was shown a picture of a baby, there was a skyrocketing line, according to the test. So genders clearly differ in their response to visual stimulus. Here's another research finding. Harvard University researchers found that early bonding is vital, that is, between mother and child. It is even related to physical health 40 or 50 years later. Incredibly, 91% of college men who said they had not enjoyed a close relationship with their mothers developed coronary artery disease, hypertension, duodenal ulcers, and alcoholism by their midlife years, 91% of the sample audience that was evaluated. Only 45% of the men who recalled maternal warmth and closeness had similar illnesses. Even more surprising is the fact that 100% of participants in this study, whose parents were cold and distant, went on to suffer numerous diseases in midlife. So you can see how important motherhood and fatherhood are, but mothers in particular. Here's another study. This is taken from Bringing Up Boys Again by Dr. Dobson. In a study conducted by Public Agenda, 70% of mothers of children under 5 wanted to leave the workforce. They wanted to leave, but in many cases, I'm sure they couldn't for financial reasons. But 70% of mothers of children under 5 wanted to leave the workforce. 71% said that daycare was the option of last resort. When asked what child care arrangement is best for young children, 70% said one parent at home is preferable. Deborah Wadsworth, president of Public Agenda, said, when it comes to handing their child over to another adult, they do not know mothers are gripped by anxiety. So these gender-linked temperaments and dispositions operating within the context of the family lend balance and strength to the relationship. So when you have both male and female characteristics coming together, husband and wife, mother and father, you have an excellent balance of emotional, psychological, and physical strengths that allow the home environment to nurture and rear and mature little children. And again, it would certainly appear that that was God's design. For indeed, as two become one, God provides us with a specific role for males and females, balancing all the factors to complement and supplement one another while at the same time creating an ideal environment for the raising and nurturing of offspring. Now, before we go to the scripture and examine some mothers in the Bible, which we will do in just a moment, I would like to read a quote from Abraham Lincoln. And I think all of us are very familiar with President Lincoln's life and his tragic death. Here is what President Lincoln said about his birth mother. You might think, because as many of you know, his birth mother died when he was age 10. And when later asked in his recollection of his mother, asked to comment on his birth mother, he said he remembered very little about her physically, other than her being a very slight woman, and she had lost most of her teeth. She was not in good health. But his mother, Nancy Hanks Lincoln, died at age 34. There apparently was some form of milk sickness, it was called. Dairy cows that were kept by small farmers apparently ate poisonous plants. The poison or toxin was transferred to the milk, and the milk caused internal difficulties, upset stomachs, fever. Some were able to overcome it. Others were killed by it. In fact, it was quite an outbreak, and several of Lincoln's relatives and friends were killed by the same disease. Abraham Lincoln was only 10 years old when his mother died. She died in the one-room log cabin where the family lived. She was buried under a tree near the cabin. Now imagine losing your mother at age 10. This is his quote as an adult regarding his mother. "All that I am or hope to be, I owe to my mother." 10 years old. 10 years old. Can you and I imagine the impact that Nancy Hanks Lincoln had on little Abe? 10 years old. Here is quite possibly the greatest president of the United States stating very clearly, "All that I am or hope to be, I owe to my mother." Quite a statement, isn't it? And I hope it shows us what an impact mothers and, of course, fathers can and should have on their children. And I hope it illustrates how a loving God provided mothers and fathers for the nurturance and the education and training and maturing of children. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 66. Isaiah 66. Verse 13. "As one whom his mother comforts, so I will comfort you, and you shall be comforted in Jerusalem." And if you look at the context here, it's talking about Zion, the city of David. It's talking about, really, in type, all of mankind. And God, through the prophet Isaiah, refers to the kindness and the compassion and the concern that he will show for all of mankind, but especially for his people, Israel, if you will, by referring to his comfort, his love and care and concern for them as being similar to a mother's love, comfort, care, and concern. God's matchless love, his tenderness, and his fidelity are compared to that of a mother. Now, the Bible abounds with accounts that depict a mother's love. Notice in Genesis 21. And when we picture a mother's love, hopefully we can picture God's love for us. When we picture our father's strength, our father's leadership, our father's willingness to defend and provide for his family, hopefully we picture God as well and get an appreciation for our Heavenly Father and Jerusalem above, which is what? The mother of us all. So the references run through the scripture. Here in Genesis chapter 21, Hagar and her son are being cast off. As you know, Abraham and Sarah tried to remedy the fact that they didn't have a son to inherit the promise that God had given them. So Sarah handed over her handmaid, and Abraham went into her. She conceived and bore Ishmael. And because of friction and tension in the family, as you can imagine, Hagar and Ishmael were sent out into the wilderness. It was a very sad time. And, of course, you can imagine how Hagar felt. Ishmael was only a babe. Notice in verse 14, Abraham rose early, took bread and a skin of water, and putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar and sent her away. Now, very sad. It must have been very hard for Abraham to do that. And yet you can see, because of mistakes and errors in judgment, it was essentially Abraham's fault, wasn't it? It wasn't a good thing to do. But oftentimes we tend to take matters into our own hands when we think God has let us down or is too slow in fulfilling our request. So when she used up her water, she was very, very discouraged. She was in the wilderness of Beersheba. And she was so depressed and discouraged. She put the boy under one of the shrubs. She went and sat down across from him, a distance of about a bow shot. What, 30, 40 yards? Why do you think she did that? She felt they were surely going to die in this wilderness. She was going to leave the baby there in the shade. She couldn't bear the sight of her baby dying. There was no water. There was no nourishment. She felt it was over. So she left the boy there. She said to herself, "Let me not see the death of the boy." So she sat opposite him, lifted up her voice, and wept. That's the love of a mother. God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, "What ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, hold him with your hand, and I will make him a great nation." Then God opened her eyes. She saw a well of water. The rest is history. But here's a mother's love. She didn't ditch the child and try to find water and food for herself. She was so concerned about the child, she was ready to give her life. She was weeping. She was crying. She was crying out to God, and God intervened. 1 Kings chapter 3. Here are two mothers, quite different. All of you are familiar with this account in 1 Kings chapter 3. The wisdom of Solomon is challenged. Two women. Sadly, they were both harlots. So they conceived and gave birth out of wedlock. Apparently, they were staying together. No one else was around. They were both asleep with their babies with them in their beds. When they awoke the next morning, one of the babies was dead. Sadly, apparently, one of the mothers had rolled over and smothered the child, but one of the babies was dead. There was suspicion that one mother had exchanged her dead baby for the other mother's live baby. And of course, with no witnesses and no DNA testing available, Whose baby is the live baby? And how do you resolve it? They came to Solomon. Obviously, they had no way of resolving it. And what a brilliant testimony to the wisdom that God granted Solomon. When they came before him and explained their situation, Solomon said, I have the answer. Bring me a sword. He said simply, in order to satisfy you both, we'll cut the baby in two and give you each half. Well, of course, that was no solution. He knew that. But it did smoke out the liar. Did it not? Or what did the true mother say? Don't do it. Give the baby to the other woman. I know it's my baby, but I want to give the baby up because I love my baby. I can give it up rather than see it killed. What did the other woman say, the impersonator? She said, do it. That's the only way to make it fair. And Solomon wisely said, give the baby to its rightful mother. So you see that the true mother was willing to give away her son to save it. Then there's the Elijah story, the widow at Zarephath, 1 Kings 17. There was a drought in the land, of course, as you know. Elijah came to the widow of Zarephath. He stayed with her. She provided for him. And after these things, of course, these miracles that provided for her and her son became ill. And her son died. And of course the mother came to Elijah and begged him to intervene. Elijah, through the power and the help of God, was able to bring the child back to life. And so the mother was truly concerned about her son, and he was brought back to life. By her pleas and her concern, she cared for him very deeply and could not possibly let him go. You know, Elisha had a similar situation with the Shunammite woman. The Shunammite woman was childless. This is in 2 Kings chapter 4, if you'd like to go there some other time. I'm not going to turn there. In 2 Kings chapter 4, the Shunammite woman and her husband gave a place of refuge and a room for Elisha to stay when he visited the area. They fed him and cared for him. And he, in an expression of concern for them and to grant their desire, told them that God would provide them with a son. And miraculously, the childless woman was granted that wish. And the little boy grew to his preteen years, but suddenly had a headache and died by mysterious causes. She immediately called for Elisha, and as you know, Elisha, with the help of God, after several attempts, was able to restore life to the little boy. Once again, the mother's love, insisting and demanding that Elisha help her in this situation to restore life to her son. So a mother's love is endless. You know, mothers love you when no one else wants to. No one else can. That's the way mothers are. Because sometimes we're unlovable. Sometimes we do things that don't warrant love. But a mother's love is consistent. It is always there. And no matter what we do, our mother still loves us. And that's, of course, a part of God's graciousness and mercy toward us as well. Now, how about Matthew 15? Here's another mother. This story is amazing. The tenacity and determination of this woman. Incredible. Matthew 15. This is a Gentile, a Syrophoenician woman Her daughter was ill, demon-possessed. She came to Christ. She cried out, "Son of David, my daughter is severely demon-possessed. Help me." Christ didn't even answer her. His disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she cries out after us." So they took their cue from Christ's silence. And when she kept crying out, begging Christ to heal her daughter, the disciples said, "Look, Christ, just send her away. We don't need this kind of distraction. We've got more important things to do." Then he finally answered and said, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I'm not going to deal with you. You're a Gentile. I was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she was relentless. She came again, worshiped him, bowed before him, saying, "Lord, help me again." Christ responded in a way that we would view as harsh, inconsiderate, insensitive, male. "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." What was she calling? What was he calling the Shunammite or the Syrophoenician woman? What was he calling her? A dog. And yet, of course, what was he doing? Testing her faith. Did she pass? Ooh, I think so. She said, verse 27, "Yes, Lord. Yes, sir." If someone called you a dog, would you say, "Yes, sir"? I don't think so. But you have to understand the context. You have to realize what Christ was doing and what Christ is going to do here in just a nanosecond. "Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table." What a brilliant answer. What a humble answer. What a persistent woman. You and I probably would have given up after the first rejection or the second rejection. But go back a third time. Or how many ever times she went back? What did Christ say? "Oh, woman, great is your faith and great is your love. Or your daughter." I added that. "Let it be to you as you desire." And her daughter was healed from that very hour. What a remarkable account. What a tenacious, determined mother, woman, and of course Christ rewarding her and commending her. Quite an example. And in fact, the best example between the disciples and the Syrophoenician woman was the Syrophoenician woman. The disciples didn't hold up under it. They didn't pass the test. She did, with flying colors. Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31. Verse 28. This is, of course, the virtuous woman or virtuous wife chapter. Speaking of her children, the virtuous mother, if you will, her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Rise up and call her blessed. Is there any richer blessing than a mother's love? The enduring comfort of a mother's love is unparalleled. As I mentioned earlier, she will love you when no one else would or no one else could. And what should be our goal in life? Well, it should be very similar to the goal of Abraham Lincoln. Very similar to the goal of Abraham Lincoln, who sought to please and to satisfy, to encourage and to honor all human beings. He wanted to leave a legacy. He wanted to honor his father and his mother. And certainly for all of us, to bring honor to our mother should be our goal in life, so that when we have finished our days, people can look upon our legacy and state unequivocally that through our lives and our energies and our determined efforts, we did bring honor to our mother. And of course, indirectly to our father. We're talking about mothers today. So as we pause tomorrow to give honor to our mothers, I hope that we will give thanks to God for creating that marvelous creature, your mother. Mothers in general and the role of motherhood. For it is a reflection of his love and care and concern for us all. And I would like to close by reading a poem entitled A Mother's Love by Helen Steiner. Helen Steiner Rice. It's entitled, of course, A Mother's Love. A mother's love is something that no one can explain. It is made of deep devotion and of sacrifice and pain. It is endless and unselfish and enduring, come what may. For nothing can destroy it or take that love away. It is patient and forgiving when all others are forsaking. And it never fails or falters, even though the heart is breaking. It believes beyond believing when the world around condemns, and it glows with all the beauty of the rarest, brightest gems. It is far beyond defining, it defies all explanation, and it still remains a secret, like the mysteries of creation. A many-splendored miracle man cannot understand, and another wondrous evidence of God's tender guiding hand. Happy Mother's Day.